From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Despite the fact that polls show an overwhelming majority of Americans support the president's nuclear agreement with Iran, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer opposes it. On Monday, a large protest gathered outside Schumer's Manhattan office to voice support for the deal. Caleb Maupin was there and filed this report.
U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer recently announced that he will vote against the recent nuclear conclusion reached between Iran and the P5 plus one nations in Vienna last month. In response, his office was targeted by protesters. Chanting, "We support the deal," the huge crowd filled an entire city block at midday in downtown Manhattan. Stephen Tenser says he thinks Schumer's opposition to the agreement is an example of corruption and the power of certain influences over U.S. politics.
And I think that Schumer is trying to sell his newfound influence in the Senate to the highest bidder rather than staying on what were his principles and trying to give peace a chance.
Many of the protesters see the outcome of the nuclear talks as a way to ensure peace.
We've seen what people like Schumer push for. We remember how he supported the Iraq War in 2003. We see the nuclear deal as a means to end that threat with regard to one country. And for that reason, there's a great deal of support for it, not only among the people gathered here today, but among the American people as a whole.
Denouncing what many call the disproportionate influence of Israel, the crowd chanted, "Barry, not Bibi," saying they favored U.S. President Barack Obama over Israeli Benjamin Netanyahu. Many of the protesters felt Schumer was not adequately representing them.
I don't know who Chuck Schumer thinks he works for, but he works for New York State, and I want him to hear the voice of New Yorkers.
A very small crowd of Zionists supporting Chuck Schumer nearby was overwhelmingly outnumbered by a huge crowd of Americans who supported the nuclear agreement. Caleb Maupin, New York.
President Obama's deal with Iran faces a tough road ahead. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
President Obama faces an uphill battle to prevent Congress from scuttling his deal to cancel massive sanctions against Iran. U.S. sanctions and Western war threats against Iran are based on the charge that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. However, in 2007 and again in 2011, all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies unanimously concluded that Iran had no military nuclear program. So, the question is, how do you deal with a U.S. policy on Iran based on lies that even U.S. intelligence agencies don't believe? We spoke with Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
It's a great question, and it's so important that you start by reminding listeners, reminding of past U.S. reports, because none of this was ever about Iran having nuclear energy. In reality, that was always nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, as it's posed, is a complete fabrication. The sanctions far predate Iran reviving its nuclear energy program. And it's always important to know and remember that the nuclear energy program was initiated by the U.S. when the Shah of Iran sat on the peacock throne in Iran. That was fine for Iran to have nuclear energy at that time. The Iranian Revolution and the effort to overturn it, to absolutely destroy it, that was why sanctions were imposed on Iran. And the early U.S. sanctions never raised nuclear energy because Iran didn't have nuclear energy at that time at all. So it is just the myth of weapons of mass destruction. It's a media weapon. And the question of the nuclear weapons was what was able to push through in Congress, a demand that every country in the world participate in the sanctions on Iran or be blocked from U.S. banks and credit and trade and aid, also from the IMF and the World Bank, from the SWIFT banking transactions, from all manner of things. It was imposed on the world on the myth that Iran was developing a nuclear weapons program. And that was, as you so well point out, always a known fact that it did not exist. That was not the basis of their research. They did not have that capacity, and so on. So ending the sanctions, that's the real question. Why disagreement now?
Opponents of any kind of agreement with Iran treat Iran's sequestered monies, Iranian monies that are frozen in banks around the world by the sanctions, they treat that money as if it is also a weapon of mass destruction, amounting to $50 billion or possibly $150 billion, and as if that's not Iran's money to do what it wishes with.
Yes, the money, actually, Iranian money, that's been held mainly by the U.S., but also other Western banks, for now decades, going back to the Iranian Revolution, but even since then, and that doesn't even count the billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in lost trade, Iran being unable to sell its oil and its products on the world market, which is another calculation. But just Iran's own money held, seized, just the first part of that is being released by this new 5+1 nuclear energy agreement. $12 billion, I believe, has been released so far back to Iran of their own money. And it really does show that this is what sanctions are all about. It's piracy. It's simply seizing. They did this in Libya, simply seized the entire funds held that were to be an African currency, the basis of an African currency in Libya. This is what was also done in Iran. Money they held around the world was laid hold of, and now is in increments going to be released back to Iran. They're not being given anything. They're getting their own money back. And this is also why, to this day, for example, the U.S. arrangement with Saudi Arabia is Saudi money is held in U.S. banks. And you can bet it would be immediately seized if there was a revolutionary upsurge in Saudi Arabia.
So the wealth of the world is actually held hostage by the United States through its control of international banking and finance.
Exactly, exactly. And that is what is also beginning to crumble. President Obama explaining to Congress why this agreement is necessary, why it happened now, said that the European Union, Russia, and China were no longer willing to abide by the sanctions imposed by the U.S. Congress. In other words, this was going to happen with or without the U.S. And so it was recognizing a reality that they can no longer impose their will exclusively around the world, that BRICS agreement and a lot of other forces, the declining value of the U.S. dollar, it really is an empire in decline and decay and less able to impose its absolute will around the world. More dangerous in some ways militarily, but financially they no longer have the unmistaken clout that they had at one time.
In that context, we could make a comparison with Obama's decision to abandon U.S. attempts to isolate Cuba because they had resulted in the U.S. itself becoming more and more isolated in Latin America.
That is exactly true. And this is what is happening on a world basis. You know, sanctions imposed on Russia over the Ukraine, where the U.S. orchestrated a fascist coup, a takeover, and then impose sanctions on Russia. U.S. businesses begin to complain that this hurts them because other alliances are then established. And they're very much being established today between Russia and China, and a whole new generation of trade coming into play with former Soviet republics. But it involves to India and Pakistan. And the U.S. is out of it. U.S. corporate power is out of it because of believing that they can be the bullies as they have been in the past.
Supporters of the administration try to compartmentalize U.S. policy, saying, well, this is our policy now in Iran, but it has nothing to do with the proxy war that's being waged by the United States and its allies in Syria.
This is the real danger now. There are enormous, very powerful forces that have been fed, trained, equipped. There are 1,000 mercenary units, about 100,000 fighters that are foreign forces in Syria today, under the pay directly equipped either by the U.S., also by Saudi Arabia, by Jordan, by Turkey, Qatar. Israel is in this completely safe havens, bases, camps. All of this has been established with the determination both to overturn Syria, to destabilize the region, and directly focused also on Iran. Now, those are the forces that may well, because their future, their profit, their very existence is based on war. Will they simply accept the Iran agreement? The very powerful forces within the U.S. in military and oil and all kinds of fields who are determined to stop the agreement with Iran. Will they use a provocation, their proxies in Syria, in order to sabotage this? It's a question we should be asking, and we need to be very much on the alert to that possibility.
Dutch investigators leading the official inquiry into the downing of a Malaysian jetliner over East Ukraine last summer found parts of a surface-to-air missile system at the crash site. Western media immediately took that information and pinned the blame on Moscow, saying that the parts belonged to a Russian missile. But apparently there's more to the story, as journalist Roman Kosarev, who's been covering it for the past year, told RT's Marina Deshashi Tuesday.
Well, I can say it right now, this is completely groundless, all the accusations in the mainstream media, and they have absolutely nothing to do with the report in the joint investigative team who are investigating the downing of the MH17. So mainstream media, such as Huffington Post, for example, they were quick to say that it was a Russian-booked missile parts that were found there. Then BBC went and said it was Russian as well. However, the Dutch investigators and their report did not say anything of the kind whatsoever. They did say, however, that they found some parts that could possibly resemble a surface-to-air missile. And it's not too hard to say what the Dutch investigators actually said. Just go to their website. We can look at the excerpt right now. And you will find, you know, that if you go that extra step, that you'll find what they actually said. We did go that extra step, and we also saw what's going on with the BBC and CNN and other mainstream media outlets in regards to this discovery. And we found out that the JIT and the mainstream media completely contradicts each other in regards to this story. So let's have a listen.
Criminal investigators in the Netherlands have said for the first time that they have found possible fragments of a Russian missile system where Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 was brought down in eastern Ukraine.
They found bits of metal, essentially, which they believe could be part, possibly is the word they use, of a Russian book missile system.
It's still under investigation whether that are parts of a book missile system or not. It's too early to draw any conclusion at this moment.
Well, it's interesting to see how different media outlets put their spin on this, of course. So going back to the question at hand, if it is book, for instance, does it mean that Russia was involved in using it automatically?
No, it does not mean that at all. Book surface-to-air missile has been sold by the Soviet Union and by Russia to over 15 countries out there in the world, including Ukraine, by the way, and the company that makes it, Almazante. They had their own investigation in this regard, and they found out that if the book had been used in MH17, it would indeed be a different modification of the weapon that stopped, that's been stopped from the production line over 16 years ago. So it's not used in the Russian army. However, other countries, including Ukraine, they're using that system, and Ukraine currently has at least 1,000 of those book missiles, the modification that's been produced in the Soviet Union earlier. So once again, it does not mean anything at all.
Yeah, but nonetheless, Russia has continually been linked to the downing of MH17, hasn't it?
Well, you know, we started talking about sensationalist headlines from the very beginning today, and that's how it's been from the very beginning with the flight MH17. Various mainstream media outlets blamed Russia right away without providing any evidence, and they said that Dutch investigators have already pointed the finger at Russia and other media outlets, but Dutch investigators, they have continually denied assigning blame to anybody whatsoever, and actually they've said that they're looking at two possible versions of this investigation. So let's have a listen to what the investigators are saying in regards to their lead.
We are investigating several scenarios. First of all, which is well known all over the world, is the scenario in which the flight MH17 was shot down by a Buk missile that was launched somewhere from the eastern Ukraine. And the second scenario we are investigating is the scenario in which a jet fighter with an air-to-air missile shot down flight MH17.
So the investigation is obviously ongoing. It's far from being complete, and Dutch investigators, they don't know the answer as to who downed that airplane. But as always, you know, people are in mainstream media are quick to assign the blame by, I guess it's wishful thinking or wanting to hear what they think is right. But the official investigation has been extended just recently.
Thai authorities faced a call Tuesday to reform the country's treason laws amid a sharp rise in the number and severity of sentencing for people found guilty of the offense. Violating that law in Thailand led to a 60-year prison sentence for one defendant who criticized the Thai monarchy on a social media site that, according to the United Nations, the spike in treason cases follows a military coup in the country in May of last year, according to the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. Daniel Johnson has more.
In one recent trial for treason, the UN Human Rights Office says that a Thai military court handed down a 60-year jail term to someone who criticized the monarchy on the internet. The sentence was commuted to 30 years, but only after the defendant pleaded guilty. That case is only one of what the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights calls shockingly disproportionate prison terms for people exercising their right to free speech. Here's OHCHR spokesperson Ravina Shandasani.
We didn't see sentences like these before. I mean, 50 years, 60 years, which are then commuted due to a guilty plea. Certainly a lot of pressure is applied on them to make their guilty pleas, and then they plead guilty. And that then leads to them not being eligible for appeal. And the only option is a pardon by the king.
Before the military coup in May 2014, the UN Human Rights Office says that just 5 people were held on treason charges in Thailand. But in the past 15 months, that number has risen to 40. Shandasani said that the treason charge is used far too arbitrarily in Thailand, and she added that the country's military courts fell far short of international fair trial standards, not just when it came to judging cases of treason. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
In the US, the charge of espionage may be used instead of the charge of treason, but the effects here are difficult to distinguish from the effects there, at least from the inside of a prison cell. In one example, there's the case of Chelsea Elizabeth Manning, formerly known as PFC Bradley Edward Manning, a U.S. Army soldier who was convicted in July of 2013 of violations of the Espionage Act and other offenses after whistleblowing on illegal activity, including murder, by the U.S. military. Manning was held for 3 years before trial, much of that time in solitary confinement. Among the 22 charges that the government filed, one charge, aiding the enemy, could have resulted in a death sentence. Manning was convicted in August 2013 to 35 years imprisonment. Meanwhile, some recent disclosures by WikiLeaks have placed a human rights report that was critical of Iran under a cloud. A confidential letter released by WikiLeaks appears to show that Saudi Arabia paid $10 million to the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Iran to bias his report against the Islamic Republic. The letter purportedly from the Saudi ambassador to Kuwait to the Saudi foreign minister, which was marked top secret, said that the embassy had paid $10 million to Ahmed Shahid and that he had promised to make an effort to pressure Tehran with his reports to the UN on human rights. Shahid, the former Maldivian foreign minister, was appointed by the UN Human Rights Council as its investigator for Iran in June of 2011 under pressure from the U.S. and its allies. At the time, Tehran said that the appointment of a special rapporteur for the country's human rights record was selective and politically motivated. The WikiLeaks website has recently released a number of confidential documents and letters from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Saudi Arabia, which apparently contain state secrets and government policy information about the country and its relations with others in the Middle East and around the world. And apparently more such documents are coming. In June, WikiLeaks said that it will publish over 500,000 Saudi diplomatic documents on the Internet. According to the latest tally published at its website as of Tuesday, 61,304 such documents have been published thus far. Saudi Arabia's air war against Yemen is in its sixth month, and it has caused a near collapse of that country's healthcare system, leaving large numbers of civilians without access to critical healthcare services. That, according to the World Health Organization. More than 22,000 civilians have been injured by the daily airstrikes since they began in March. The UN Health Agency announced Tuesday that almost 25% of all health facilities in the country are currently non-functional or partially functional as a direct result of the ongoing attacks. Stephanie Kutrix reports.
Over 15 million people are reportedly in need of health services and life-saving assistance in Yemen, especially in Aden, Abyan, Taiz, and Saada governorates. The president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, concluded a three-day visit to the country on Tuesday. While visiting the Mansour Hospital in Aden, he said he was appalled by the suffering he witnessed.
When I came to the hospital, the emergency room was empty. Now, half an hour later, I go back out of the hospital, and there are two new patients which have been really heavily affected by cluster bombs, mines. I have seen people who have been tortured, who have been slain through the roads, and who have really been physically destroyed. This is a very serious, a catastrophic situation which unfolds here in Aden, and much more needs to be done in order to support those victims who suffer each and every day from this conflict.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, the World Health Organization said health facilities are continuing to shut down week by week. Most recently, a renal dialysis center in Harad Governorate closed due to insecurity in the area. The agency asked for $151 million U.S. to meet the health needs of internally displaced people until the end of 2015, but has only received $23 million. That's a funding gap of 85%, which WHO spokesperson Tariq Jasarevich says will force critical healthcare services to shut down.
Now, the situation in general in Yemen is very, very difficult because of the departure of the health professionals who are fleeing the violence, and this leads obviously to shortages of qualified health workers, creating gaps in the provision of primary health care, trauma and surgical care, as well as obstetric care.
Mr. Jasarevich added that power and fuel shortages, which has resulted in the closure of intensive care units and operation rooms in almost all hospitals across the country, are further exacerbating the situation. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
There were reports Tuesday from Ferguson, Missouri, that members of an armed group of white males called the Oath Keepers Militia, which consists of former and current police and military officers, arrived in the troubled city early Tuesday, armed with semi-automatic assault rifles and handguns. RT reported that upon their arrival in Ferguson, they moved through the crowd of protesters saying, "We're on your side." But despite that claim, the appearance of the heavily armed white men greatly concerned activists from the Black Lives Matter group, with prominent activist Kayla Reed asking in a tweet, quote, "Why are there men with guns and the police are doing nothing?" Closed quote. The group's website at oathkeepers.org says it is a, quote, nonpartisan association of current and formerly serving military, police, and first responders who pledge to fulfill the oath all military and police take to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, closed quote. That oath, it says, is to the Constitution, not to politicians, adding that, quote, Oath Keepers declare that they will not obey unconstitutional orders, such as orders to disarm the American people, to conduct warrantless searches, or to detain Americans as enemy combatants in violation of their ancient right to jury trial, closed quote. The group has been in Ferguson before over the past year, and they apparently were not welcomed by law enforcement officials. The following is an excerpt from video published by RT America at its YouTube site last December. It includes an interview with a man named Sam Andrews, who said he was a member of the group's Missouri chapter.
The Oath Keepers have not been embraced by many of the higher-ups within local police departments or by federal law enforcement.
On Thursday night, they surrounded our building with over 50 men and told us to get off the roof and put our arms down or they would arrest us. A security operation is how they termed it to me.
What does that mean, a security operation? So you're basically security guards because you're on the roof?
Well, that's what they're claiming. But if you read the statute, and English words still mean what they mean, it clearly says if you are employed by a corporation as a security personnel, and there's three or four different descriptions of different types of security personnel, they all have the word employed in it because they have to. You can't regulate volunteers.
Sam says a former Marine who was on his team also spotted a three-man sniper team taking position and pointing rifles at the Oath Keepers. It is law enforcement leadership that Sam says that's trying to push Oath Keepers out, despite the fact that they are in this community and working for the rights of everyone.
We're from Oath Keepers. Just wanted you to know we're here to protect you guys. We're about supporting everybody's rights. Okay. And so don't let the media lie about us. Tell the truth. We love everybody and we care about everybody.
An attempt to reach the militia group through its website was met with a caveat that, quote, due to recent media attention, we are experiencing delays in our responses, closed quote. Meanwhile, as St. Louis County declared a state of emergency, about 60 protesters, including prominent activist Cornel West, were arrested Monday in front of the federal courthouse at a rally organized on the anniversary of Michael Brown's death. Also arrested were Black Lives Matter activists DeRay McKesson and Jeanette Elzey, who were filming the protests. At another protest, where traffic was being blocked, more than 60 protesters were taken into custody. Policy analyst and data scientist for We the Protesters, Samuel Sinyangwe, told RT that the police are still treating protesters and the community at large with a heavy hand, and that this has to change.
There's an entire system in place that has been built over decades, if not generations, that needs to be dismantled. We need to address police union contracts, for example, that in many ways have prevented civilian oversight from being effective and empowered. We need to address a culture that basically takes the police narrative for granted. I think we've made some progress on that. Now when people are killed by police, they're starting to question the story. But more work needs to be done. For example, we saw events yesterday. People were very quick to immediately attribute the shootings to the boy who was killed. And we really don't know the facts. The investigation isn't complete. And yet people are very quick to blame what happened on the person who really was experienced the most violence that day. We've seen the protests over the past year have taken place, dozens and dozens and dozens of protests. The vast majority of those peaceful. I think that has continued just because there are a few outside agitators who may come in and try to disrupt the moments. And the work that is being done is not an indictment on the protesters. If anything, it shows that there is a resistance to clearly progress that is being made on both sides. I think really people are happy about some of the progress that's being made, are happy about community that's being built. We're excited to continue to build, continue that work. We've seen them declare a state of emergency, which is very bad because when you think about it, police in St. Louis kill black men at a rate higher than the U.S. murder rate. But yet when we see protests, sustained protests, that is considered an emergency. And I think that's precisely the problem. The police are really, really inflaming tensions by basically declaring a state of emergency. We saw yesterday how they responded with armored vehicles again, really activating the traumas of communities. And I think when they do that, it really not only inflames tension, but it creates a context in which people don't feel safe. People feel like they have to get out of those situations. They have to fight back. They have to resist. And I think police should be making us feel safer instead of inflaming things.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.